Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two interviews up tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Tony Hendra, who is the editor-in-chief of a parody of the Wall Street Journal, the Rupert Murdochized Wall Street Journal called My Wall Street Journal. He did a similar parody of a very different newspaper in 1982 called Off the Wall Street Journal. He and, of course, some very very funny and competent colleagues. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Kevin Phillips, the former Republican political strategist turned renegade and critic of the Bush regime and General Cassandra about American politics and economics, with his latest dark message. This one is his new book called Bad Money, just out from Penguin. We'll hear from Kevin Phillips at the bottom of the hour. And before we get up to all that, some of the news. More bad news from the housing market this week. On Tuesday, the National Association of Realtors reported that sales of existing houses in March are off 18% from a year earlier. That's actually a slight improvement from the previous 3 months, when the declines year to year were over 20%. The average price of an existing house was down just over 8% from a year earlier, a slight improvement from February, but that was the worst reading yet on this down cycle. And 2 days later, on Thursday, the Census Bureau reported that sales of new houses in March were off almost 37% from last year's level, also the second worst reading on this down cycle. Prices were off over 13% for the year, almost twice the previous record for this cycle. There are almost 10 months' worth of existing houses on the market based on the current sales pace, and 11 months of new houses. Neither is a record high, but both are close and are close to twice their long-term averages. In a phrase, the housing market is in the depths of a deep decline. So how much more of this is there to come? A lot of the sales and price measures are around the levels they reached at the bottom of earlier housing swoons, like those of the mid-70s, early 80s, and early 1990s. There are two things that aren't comforting about this historical precedent, though. One is that the boom was so extreme and so without precedent that you might expect the bust to probe fresh negative territory. And the second is that even after what people on Wall Street sometimes call the momentum low, the point at which the percentage declines are at their maximum negatives, prices and sales can continue to decline, although at a slower rate. So again, based on historical precedents, it could be another year or two before the housing market truly turns around. That means further downward pressure on household finances and the broad economy. In other words, we're not done with this yet. The other week, economists at Goldman Sachs did an analysis based on the ratio of house prices to rents. House prices got way above rents during the boom and are only now correcting that excess. Their analysis suggests that we're only halfway through the bust. That seems about right to me. So count this as further evidence that we probably have another year or two of this to go. But where will another year or two of this take us? How badly will it ravage household finances, and how many millions will be bankrupted by it? How much damage will this do to the job market, and how much more financial fallout will there be? I have to say, though, that the failure of the stock market to collapse is one piece of evidence that things aren't going straight to hell. That's a sharp contrast with the deep recessions of the mid-70s and early 80s, not to mention the depression of the 1930s. Though the stock market is often untethered from reality, its long-term trend is an important measure of the financial system's liquidity and the general state of bourgeois confidence. So putting all this together, I'm sticking with my prediction that we're facing tough economic times, but not Armageddon. While many are worried about the economic implosion in the U.S., much of the rest of the world is experiencing anything but that. Asia is booming and inflation is rising around the Pacific Rim. Australia, Singapore, and China are all seeing some of their highest inflation rates in a long time. The driving forces remain, as I've been pointing out here for a long time, rising costs of energy and food. Always on the lookout for an opportunity to make money, speculators are buying up farmland and driving its price up around the world. This could have the truly perverse effect of driving food prices up even higher than they would be otherwise, and driving even more of the world's poor to the brink of starvation. Higher energy prices could have a beneficial effect, encouraging us to use less of it and thereby help postpone the date of climate catastrophe. While there are quite a few Americans who could do with eating less, raising the price of food is a very risky way to accomplish that goal, since it quite literally could doom millions to death by starvation. And unless your name is Malthus, that's horrible news. This will be my last regular WBAI show until the beginning of June. I'll be here some during the fundraiser, of course, which runs from May 7 to 31st, but that's not regular programming. And the authorities have decided that Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash will get 6 hours next Thursday, including this hour, to do a May Day special. I'd hoped to have Joel Covell on to discuss the new edition of his book, The Enemy of Nature. I thought that an exploration of the relationship between capitalism and the destruction of our environment would be a good May Day topic in 2008, but it is not to be. But I will be doing that interview for the KPFA edition of this show, to be broadcast in Berkeley on the morning of Saturday, March 3rd. I'll also be doing a couple of KPFA-only shows during our fundraiser, including a talk with Stephen Greenhouse about his new book on the screwing of the American worker, The Big Squeeze. These will be broadcast in Berkeley on the mornings of May 24th and 31st. WBAI listeners can catch them online at kpfa.org or on my own radio archive at leftbusinessobserver.com. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Tony Hendra. That was a bit of the Rondo in A major, D951 for two pianos by Franz Schubert, performed by Claire Ebersold and Ralph Neuwiem, or Neuwiem, or I think it's Dutch. I'm not fluent in Dutch. Today's first interview is with Tony Hendra, the editor of the chief of My Wall Street Journal, a parody of the Business Daily, which is now owned by Rupert Murdoch. The Business Daily is not the parody, of course. For a long time, the Journal was, in many ways, the best newspaper in the U.S. Despite its reputation in some circles as a business rag, which is true of the editorial page, but not of news pages, it was actually full of serious examinations of social and economic life in the U.S. and around the world. It was also beautifully edited, far more stylish than the usual prose in a newspaper, and a sharp contrast with the awfulness of writing in the New York Times. It's scary to think about what Murdoch is going to do to this paper. He wants to make it newsier, with less of the analytical stories that distinguish the old Journal, and to reduce the ratio of editors to reporters, meaning it will be a lot less fun to read. Anyway, a perfect opportunity for a parody. Tony Hendra, a veteran of the old National Lampoon and many other comic venues, was also the top editor of a brilliant 1982 parody of the Journal, which was called Off the Wall Street Journal. I still have a copy somewhere in my files, or I might have to hire a search party to find it. My Wall Street Journal is on sale in newsstands and bookstores, Amazon.com, and on their website. Okay, here's Tony Hendra. Welcome, Tony Hendra. 26 years later, a different product, a different culture to parody. Let's start, first of all, with the different culture. Back in 1982, Wall Street was pretty obscure. The bull market hadn't really started. Now Wall Street is pervasive. We've got CNBC and people think about the stock market all over the place, talking about the stock market. Did that change your approach to doing this?
Well, I mean, one thing should be remembered, which is that in 1982, we were in the middle of a recession. The Reagan recession, the first one, and now we're in a recession again. So, I mean, there is that is in common. I think the real difference, actually, I'm not sure how sort of obscure Wall Street was. By 1982, Wall Street actually had become kind of cool. I mean, there was that very definite sort of preppy, conservative reaction to the 70s that was almost self-conscious, and certainly the group of guys who approached me all came from the University of Chicago and were all sort of monetarists. You know, they'd been students of Milton Friedman, and they thought of themselves as very cool, and Wall Street is very sort of the up-and-coming thing. So, I mean, in the sense that in the sense that Wall Street has now become sort of popularized. Day trading is a sufficiently large market that it can actually be catered to. I think there is a difference. But the real difference, actually, is much more specific. In 1982, and we did one in 1983 too, the Wall Street Journal was institutional. It was a massive, unchanging institution. It had quirks, it had style, it had a certain way of approaching stories. Apart from
it was also kind of stodgy and almost Midwestern too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was very easy to parody, in fact. And especially its Neanderthal, you know, editorial page, which was just unbelievable. But it was actually, off the Wall Street Journal was a kind of one-for-one parody. And it was great fun. And we had moles inside the Wall Street Journal who gave us all kinds of tips about style and so forth. And the result was very popular, I think mainly with sort of readership of the Wall Street Journal. But this time around, one is dealing with a totally different comic premise. Here, the comic premise was, what will the Wall Street Journal look like when Rupert Murdoch has had his dastardly way with it? And so what you're dealing with is less a parody than, I don't know what the word is quite, a travesty. I mean, you're taking an institution, one of the, you know, one of the, whatever you may think of it, one of the best newspapers left in America, certainly in terms of journalistic reliability, and you're vulgarizing it to the nth degree. And that's really, that's a very different kind of comic premise.
Well, you actually anticipated one of my questions, which is, how does one parody the Wall Street Journal editorial page, which, as Michael Thomas once said, is what the paper has instead of comics?
That's very good. I hadn't heard that. But, I think you just take it one step further. I mean, our lead editorial, for example, is entitled The Wellstone Option. And it discusses how it might be necessary to remove Senator Obama sometime between now and the election, but we shouldn't really be thinking about that. And in no way are we advocating it, and so forth and so on. So, I mean, you take it, you can still take things one step further.
But then you have Peggy Noonan in there instead of the old style crone or something.
Maggie Noonan, please. Yeah. Maggie Noonan. Yes, right. Yes, her column is called Mourning in America, where mourning is what you do to dead people. What's funny about that is not just that it's, I think, a brilliant parody of Peggy Noonan. It's written by Anne Hodgman, actually, who's a wonderful writer and old friend of mine. But what we do to it is she's sort of going on in her, you know, rather verbose kind of style in this particular case about how wonderful it was in the days of Ronald Reagan and brown suits and, you know, wonderful sunsets and so on. And suddenly we just cut her off. She's just in the mid-sentence. She's just, and it says, Maggie Noonan is a former columnist for the, you know, the Wall Street Journal.
Hook.
You know, that's a good example of what you do. In the old days, we would simply have parodied Peggy Noonan, but in this case, you have to do something more extreme.
And of course, it being now a Murdoch property, lots of cross promotion involved. Huh?
Well, actually, yes. I mean, you know, Fox News is all over our parody, but in fact, our the slogan, the tagline of my Wall Street Journal is "We distort, you decide," and you know, we use that kind of thing quite frequently throughout. There's a show which is being promoted in the parody called Fox News Idol, where aspiring newscasters come on and do the actual news for 5 minutes, and there's a panel of judges and so forth. And so it's, yes, there's a lot of cross promotion. But frankly, I mean, the Wall Street Journal itself is rapidly taking on, you know, the color of a house organ for News Corp. What actually gave us this idea of sort of incestuous promotion within the paper was that there was one time, it was the day after the Super Bowl, and there was one section of the actual Wall Street Journal that had a story about Fox News and its triumph, you know, Fox Sports, its triumph at the Super Bowl, and then it also had a story on the same page about how News Corp's earnings, unlike everyone else, had edged up in 2007. And then you turned the page, and there was a couple of ads, and you turned the next page, was about MySpace, you know, and how MySpace was making far more money than all its competitors like Facebook and so on. I mean, it was just naked self-promotion. I mean, it wasn't journalism at all. So it's actually happening in the paper, and I'm sure it's going to continue happening.
As I recall, the first off the Wall Street Journal, there was a certain degree of affection in the parody. It seemed that you liked the Wall Street Journal, but it was pretty. It's easy to poke fun at. But when you get Rupert Murdoch involved, one's emotional attitude changes, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's it isn't actually that much of an attack on Rupert Murdoch personally, but although there's some very funny things in it, like Bruce McCall, who's this wonderful artist and writer. Does this sort of inside look at the Murdoch Mansion, which is being built on top of a building, 834 Fifth Avenue, and it costs like $50 million. You know, it has this. It's a wonderful piece, but for the most part, it's not really directly aimed at attacking Rupert. What it is aimed at is his sensibility and you know the sort of vulgarization of the culture that I think he brings. He's not just going to bring it to the Wall Street Journal. He's already brought it to all kinds of other areas of the culture. So you know to that degree, it is I suppose it has a very different purpose. We certainly didn't want to we weren't attacking the Wall Street Journal. In the first two parodies, by any means, we were just, as you say, having fun. I wouldn't say that it was affection exactly, but we were definitely having a lot of fun with its stylistic quirks and so on. But this time, I think we possibly want to make a more sort of destructive point, if you like.
Yeah, I noticed also some New York Posty features creeping in, page 6, and a Cindy Adams clone.
Yes, Cindy Madams, we call her, yeah. But no, that was that's our operating sort of design and editorial premise was that the cover of my Wall Street Journal would still look roughly like the Wall Street Journal does. I mean, the Wall Street Journal itself is becoming much more like USA Today with, you know, skyboxes and color and caricatures and so on. But our idea was that the cover, the front page of the paper would look something like the Wall Street Journal, but then throughout the parody, throughout the 24 pages of the parody, it would kind of disintegrate into the New York Post and just get more and more stylistically, you know, vulgar and crazy and wild, until on the penultimate page, the inside back page, it just becomes a house organ called News Corp News, and it's in a New York Post head style headline.
But then there's the intrusion of some anti-capitalist protesters at Fox headquarters.
Oh yes, absolutely. We actually have had a lot of fun with that kind of idea. I don't know if you've seen the video that we did. Well, I can't really describe it. You have to sort of see it. But we shot a video which purportedly was done inside News Corp of Murdoch going crazy at the parody and cursing out all the people who'd allowed it to happen and demanding that all the copies be burnt and so on and so on.
Actually, he probably appreciates the attention. I would guess Rupert is a canny guy. I'm speaking with Tony Hendra, who is the head editor of My Wall Street Journal, a parody of the Murdoch Eyes Daily. My Wall Street Journal, is that because, don't they call their websites My Fox or something?
Well, it's partly, the main reason for it is that it is Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, so he welcomes you to it, and it's My Wall Street Journal. And, you know, the editorial page is My Opinions. And there is the secondary level, obviously, that MySpace has sort of triggered a whole slew of various entities using that particular possessive. So my seems to be a word that's somehow in currency.
Oh, as I recall, though, that some of the Wall Street Journal editorial people were concerned that Rupert wasn't a real conservative, so they're a little nervous about his influence.
That's right. Well, I think that's probably true. I think, you know, he was Red Rupert when he was at Cambridge, and I've actually spoke to a lot of people about that before I started putting this together. I think his politics are entirely convenience politics. He sails under whatever flag, you know, will make him the most money. I don't think he gives a damn that he sits down with Chinese communists to make one bunch of money, and then he comes over here and sits down with the likes of William Crystal, or as I prefer to call him, Billy Crystal, and makes money that way. You know, makes no difference to him.
You've got a story about the danger of biofuels. What's that?
Oh, yes, that's the headline on that story. Perhaps I should read the headline because it's fairly explicit. This is about the food crisis, and the headline is Poor Nations Eating the U.S. to a Standstill. We need biofuel, they want dinner. And basically it's about, it's a very sort of anti-poor, pro-business piece about how we ought to be, you know, buying up agricultural land wherever we can find it and using it for fuel.
And that is still early on in the paper when you're in the serious news pages. As we get to the back, we get towards the lifestyle sections, which are also getting more prominent in the journal. What's in the lifestyle?
Well, the lifestyle has there are various aspects of it. One of my favorite is the cleaning lady who sees the virgin in Merrill Lynch's fourth quarter loss curve. Which is very sweet. And then we have net pets too, which is a new concept in timesharing. When you take your net jet, you know, you obviously need a net pet to take along with you. There's a very good column, I think, on advertising, which is called Madness Avenue. And then there's just there's a section which is quite naked. It's called Buying and Having. And it reviews the 2008 trophy wives, who you know, you can get from various mostly Asian countries. And there's the Bradley Fighting limousine, which I like a lot. Bradley Fighting limousine is, you know, is a fully armed limousine that you just can go anywhere, do anything, be anybody.
And of course, you have a breaking story that the South will secede if Obama becomes president.
Absolutely, and the market is actually going up on the prospect of a nuclear civil war.
Because they've got so many of the weapons, don't they? It's not like last time.
No, I mean, it points out that actually, and this is true, I mean, the South is armed to the teeth. I mean, if the South did choose to secede, it would be very difficult to beat them. And we have a wonderful visual in that of F-22 Raptors with Confederate markings on the wings.
And in News Corp news, there's going to be Mother Dow Jones.
Oh, yes. Mother Dow Jones is the first green magazine for neocons. And it has some fun cover lines, too. We actually reproduce the cover of that. And it's, you know, it's whether there are things like whether CEOs should actually organize into a union, you know, and a bunch of new right-wing environmental groups like Acquaintances of the Earth, which is my particular favorite.
Tell us about who produced this, aside from yourself.
Well, it's kind of a stellar group. Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report, is very prominent in it. Richard Belzer, who is probably better known to most people as Detective Munch of Law and Order, but is actually was for many years a wonderful comedian, a political comedian, and still is very, you know, very funny guy. And we have Terry Jones of Monty Python, who's an old friend of mine. We have Patty Marks from The New Yorker and Bruce McCall from The New Yorker, and we have writers from The Daily Show, Todd Hanson and Tim Harrod from The Onion. You know, we sort of cover the comedy beat, and it's I must say it is an extraordinary group. I mean, I as somebody said the other day, every inch is funny. There's a joke in every inch, and that's really a mark of the kind of people that I have writing for it.
Well, and I agree too. I'll give you an editorial endorsement myself. Are we going to see any more of these sorts of? Will we see Mother Dow Jones, for example? That's what I'd like to see.
Yes, it would be very funny to produce it. I haven't thought about that. This was an enormous amount of work for, you know, 24 pages, and I also had to pull an enormous number of favors, which mostly at local advertising agencies, to put together these parody ads, which are very, very beautifully done. So I think to do this on a regular basis would probably be more than it couldn't be too regular. In other words, perhaps as a quarterly. But actually, my real goal is to sort of take this format and put it on the web as a satirical newspaper, ongoing. That's how I'd like to. I'd like this to be, even though it's in print, to be a sort of beta version of of a satirical website.
Well, God knows we need it. There's not much material of that sort, and we certainly need it. I doubt you've heard from Rupert Murdoch, but have you heard from anybody at the Journal?
Well, there was a very funny story in the New York Times, actually, which was the day before we came out, and the journalist there, Richard Perez Pena, had got a tip from Los Angeles, where apparently some newsstands were putting the parody out early. It wasn't supposed to be out until Tuesday of this week, but they put it out on Friday. And at one of these newsstands, this tipster, this friend of a person at the New York Times, saw a Wall Street Journal employee, who he knew to be a Wall Street Journal employee, was a Wall Street Journal rep, buying up all the copies of the Wall Street Journal parody off this newsstand that he happened to be at. And apparently the guy told the newsstand operator that he'd been going around just buying all the copies he could find.
Good for your circulation, but not good for visibility.
Yeah, right? But, you know, if Rupert wants to buy them all, that's fine. $1 million, you know, it's nothing to him. He drops that much on the New York Post every day.
So this will be on newsstands through mid-May?
Yes, it came out this week on Tuesday the 15th, tax day, obviously, and it'll be on newsstands for a month. It's also on Amazon, any bookstore that you'd care to ask for it, and we probably will be gradually making it available as an ebook too. In other words, you'll be able to download it in a couple of weeks, maybe a week or so.
And there's a website?
There is indeed, wsjparody.com. And that will, you know, that will give you more information.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tony. Great stuff. And that was Tony Hendra, who's the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal parody, My Wall Street Journal. And I wanted to say in introducing Hendra, and I forgot, that earlier this week, Marcus Brockley, who is the managing editor of the journal, left. He was considered one of the buffers between Rupert and the old-style seriousness of the Wall Street Journal. He left. People are drawing parallels to when Harold Evans left the Times of London early in Rupert's ownership of that paper. There had been an editorial committee that was set up that was supposed to act as some kind of wall between the vulgar mind of Rupert Murdoch and the journalistic traditions of the Times of London. Something similar has been set up at the Journal. When Evans left the Times, it was clear that committee was completely ineffectual, and people are now drawing similar conclusions that Marcus Brockley has left the Wall Street Journal. There are some bright spots to Rupert's ownership of the Journal. I will concede. He wants to go after the New York Times, which offered some stiff competition, and God knows that paper needs a good shaking up. And the publisher he's chosen, Robert Thompson, who was previously the editor of the Times of London, and before that the U.S. editor of the Financial Times, is a smart and serious guy who I've actually met, and I find him a fairly impressive person. So that's one bright spot in all this. But maybe you don't care about the Wall Street Journal. I do, and I'm also concerned about the ongoing vulgarization and stupidification of discourse in the United States, and I just worry that seeing the Journal go down the Rupert Murdoch route is a further move in that direction. Okay, well, let's take a break for station ID, and we will be back.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WVAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
And let's take a musical break, and then we'll be back to hear from Kevin Phillips. And that a bit of The Clash, I'm So Bored with the USA. I complained a few weeks ago about 68 nostalgia. Well, that was a bit of 78 nostalgia. Next Wednesday, the 30th, is the 30th anniversary of the Rock Against Racism concert in London, which The Clash were organizers and headliners. So it was nice to hear a little bit of the Clash. Okay, now, Kevin Phillips. Kevin Phillips came to prominence as the architect of the Southern Strategy, which was the use of race in order to win the South over to the Republican Party. He has not publicly repented. He has somewhat repented indeed by turning on the Republicans and becoming a very vigorous critic of empire and plutocracy. His latest contribution is Bad Money, just out from Penguin Press, and he is full of dire predictions about the future course of events in the United States. Kevin Phillips.
Well, Kevin Phillips, you paint what looks like a picture of the U.S. in some sort of epic world historical decline. Is that a fair characterization of your argument?
Well, I don't think it's too much of an overstatement. I think at any time, the leading world economic power that's been pretty much in charge for 50 or 75 years or even a century starts declining, that's a major event. And I think, frankly, that we are, and I think it will be a major event. And I don't think it's too far along yet, but I think George W. Bush has speeded it up, and the decades of the 2010s and the 2020s will be when we suffer our damage.
This argument was somewhat popular in the days of Paul Kennedy in the 80s. It receded in the 90s. Was that just the bubble and the boom and that kind of false optimism is stripped away, or is there something happened?
There's actually a longer history. You can go back, and I've looked at this pretty carefully. To say 1968, 69, 70, 71, the global currency crises. And some books were coming out at that point. This is when the United States closed the gold window, about how it's the beginning of the end of the empire. And then after Watergate and Indochina, another round in 1975 and 76. Then in the late 1980s, you got the round that most people still remember, which was the rise of Japan was a threat to U.S. hegemony. And now you have this one. Now, if you go back and look at the British, it's eerie how there was roughly the same pattern.
I want to talk about these historical precedents. You list several, Spain, the Netherlands, right, and Britain. I think Britain is probably the most relevant to the American situation, the one that Americans probably feel the most sympathy with and the most closest in history. So what are the precedents in British decline that make you feel that eerie feeling?
Well, there are a lot, but just the basic pattern of a leading world economic power declining, it has a number of ingredients, and obviously there's always a sense of malaise that things have gone wrong and the old spirit isn't there anymore, and we certainly have that. You have a change in the economy. The economy moves away from industry or agriculture or fishing or whatever it was that people did that was work, and it moves towards finance. It does this because as you get a global hegemony, you become more and more in a position to be the dominant force in sort of financial and insurance and commercial services. And the Dutch did that, and then the British did it. And slowly but surely, the British were moving away from industry towards finance, and there were people who opposed this, who raised questions in Parliament, and they were never fully answered, but that didn't stop financialization. The ultimate problem for the Brits came when they overreached militarily and imperially in two world wars. They had to borrow to survive, borrow to win, but they didn't win economically. And essentially by 1949, they were devaluing the pound, and they were in their fourth year of food rationing after World War II. The mighty had fallen.
There's some people who think that the decline of the dollar is a sign of long-term decline. Others say it is going to restore competitiveness and put the international accounts back into balance. Which side of that argument do you fall on?
Totally on the first side. I might phrase it differently, but essentially if you go and you look at the gyrations of sterling in the 20th century, you can see that in the period before World War I, it ran at about $5. As war broke out in Europe, there was a major downward gyration. There was another loss after it recovered in 1919 after the British temporarily went off gold in order to lick inflation, which had been a problem after the war. Then they had to go off gold forever in the early 1930s, and the pound dropped again. Then they had to devalue after World War II, and the pound went down to 280. And then somewhat later, it went down to 240. And there was a time during the 1980s, you may remember, when the pound and the dollar were almost equal and the world was flocking to Harrods. And now, of course, it's back up virtually to $2, and the Brits are coming over here. But it was a very effective demarcation of the decline of Britain to watch what happened to the pound.
The mirror of the decline of the dollar has been the rise of the euro. Does that say something about Europe's fate?
I have a little problem with the rise of the euro. It won't have the same significance as the rise of the dollar because the United States was able to command hegemony in its own right as the leading manufacturer, the leading lending nation, the leading financial power, the leading oil producer, everything. Whereas Europe really leads in nothing, and it doesn't have one of the major markets. It doesn't have Tokyo, it doesn't have London, it doesn't have New York. Now, I would say if the British go into Europe, then the euro might emerge and challenge the dollar. But otherwise, I would say the dollar recedes from its leadership, but is not overturned by a specific currency.
Well, if we look at the previous examples of this sort of imperial passage or the passage of the hegemon, there seemed to be someone waiting in the wings in previous historical cycles. Is there this time?
It doesn't require the obviousness of one country waiting in the wings. The British were emerging during the 18th century, even though the rivalry with France was fierce. Nobody could be sure the French wouldn't come out on top until the Napoleonic Wars were over. The Industrial Revolution favored the British, and some could say, well, it always did ensure that they would come out on top. But they were pulling ahead, and sterling was pulling ahead as the leading currency while they were still locked in a death fight with France. The Dutch, you can raise questions there, too. So I would say it's not that there has to be a single emerging nation for the leading power that held it before to decline, but you have to have forces that are pulling it down, and then at a certain point in its decline, something has to emerge. And frankly, I don't think that something is Europe. I know Alan Greenspan does, but I wouldn't change my mind until the Brits go into Europe, and if they do.
Not sure I'd want to take Alan Greenspan's advice on many things.
Well, I agree with that.
I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, prolific author, most recently of Bad Money. We've had several very similar economic and political and cultural cycles in American history, late 19th century Gilded Age, the 1920s. What's different about this one that I guess began with the bull market in 1982?
Well, what I would say, the first major change in the economy was from agriculture to railroads and industry in the 1880s and 1890s. Now, people knew that change was taking place, and it was an enormous political debate. Very much talked about, especially in the farm states. This one hasn't been talked about, and I hope it will be now. It's clear that finance has moved ahead of manufacturing by far in the gross domestic product. It's up to 20 to 21%. Manufacturing's down to 12%. There's a whole history over two decades of finance getting every break you can imagine, and it hasn't been written about. And here we now have everybody's nervous about the financial sector, and they sure should be. It went from being way down the list in the 1970s to being top economic dog at this point. And I think it's done what industry and railroads did. It's basically escaped regulation for the quarter century of its rise and taking over. It's even had government complicity, which the railroads certainly had too. And here we have it. We have this malfactoring, if I can make up a verb, financial sector. Had a chairman of the Federal Reserve who just loved them to death, gave them everything they wanted, and is now busy apologizing for the neglect of his oversight function. But the joke is on everybody else because we have all these things going wrong with the country's finances.
What about the role of religion? This has been a very religious country from the outset. There's often been a very tight relation between religion and the worship of money. Is there something different about religion in this cycle since the rise of fundamentalism in the late 1970s?
The one difference that I see that's been a major problem out of religion that we didn't have before is it played a major role in a foreign policy that has sucked us into a morass that is probably focusing more than anything else the question of our imperial overreach and inability to afford it. And that's the involvement of people concerned with the Bible over what's happening in the Middle East. The principal force is Christian fundamentalism, but it's not the only one. And that was one of the reasons for major involvement in the Middle East, along with oil. And they botched it on the oil front. That was one of the least advertised but most bungled resource wars in world history. And the whole religious thing, I think, is receding now because the religious right got the bejesus kicked out of it, to use a bad phrase, in the 2006 elections. And I don't worry about them. When Huckabee ran in the Republican primaries, I don't think he really did too well that couldn't have been expected of somebody in the South who was funnier and seemed like a nicer person and did better for a while and didn't get anywhere. That doesn't represent a great flexing of muscle by a latter-day Ku Klux Klan or anything. It was just a second echelon candidate.
People have argued, Tom Frank very famously, that religion and other cultural issues have been a distraction to the electorate from their underlying economic problems. Barack Obama attracted a lot of attention recently for making a somewhat similar argument. Do you buy that?
Well, I buy some of it. I thought Kansas was a very unfortunate selection because Kansas is really in the Bible Belt. And it isn't unusual for Kansas to take this view. It was a very prohibitionist and pro-William Jennings Bryan place most of the time. And the notion that they are disregarding their best economic interest to go off on all these ideological tangents. Well, I understand why somebody says that. I haven't seen anything about a Democratic administration since I've been in Washington that suggests that whether it was Lyndon Johnson or Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton was thinking about Kansas too much. Essentially, Kansas has preoccupied itself with issues which I think haven't been constructive. But have they missed the dynamic economic policies and concern about the ordinary American that's held up by the Democratic Party? Well, if you've seen it for any length of time with any sincerity, tell me about it. Because what we're looking at, Hillary and Billary and the whole family there with $106 million since they got out of the White House, these are friends of the ordinary American? You know, maybe.
Bill Clinton said the other day that the poorest first family to enter the White House in 100 years, but they didn't emerge that way, did they?
Well, even before they emerged from the White House, I wouldn't say they were selling pardons, but there was certainly a slight whiff of money changing hands in the Mark Rich affair. I just think, very unfortunately for Hillary, who I think is a very bright woman, the whole problem of having married the morality of Bill Clinton is catching up with her, and I think they're tarred. I think his role in history is going down. But my larger point is that I don't think there was all that much about what the Democrats stood for under Bill Clinton that was something that Kansas should have been attracted to. I understand what was wrong with being attracted to the extreme wing of the Republican Party from a practical standpoint, but I don't see that they were missing out on something that the Democrats really offered.
Your book has almost nothing to say about Barack Obama. I guess you'd finished it before his spectacular rise. What do you make of, and you seem to assume that Hillary was the likely nominee, so what do you make of this transformation of their fortunes?
Well, I wish I could be sure of what I would expect from an Obama administration. I'm not. I think he's shown me that some of his sense of political maneuvering doesn't do too well, and when chips come down that you can really expect him to come down from the Republicans, either in the general election or in Washington if he were to be elected president. So I'm not convinced if he gets in there that he can put all of his lofty thoughts, and I think they mostly are fairly lofty, into effect.
Do you mean lofty in a somewhat disparaging way?
No, and in the sense of his larger overviews, many of which I sort of agree with. He says more what I like on economics than Hillary does. And John McCain is an enormous disappointment. I would have voted for him in 2000 when he understood exactly what George W. Bush represented. But at this point, he's, you know, he's kissing the imperial cowboy boot, and I'm not up for that.
We're now like 40 years after the Southern strategy. What do you make of the argument by, say, Thomas Schaller that the Republicans are too much a Southern party and that this really weakens them as over the longer term?
Well, I was just on a panel with Schaller, and he said, and I knew he was right, that he got a lot of those ideas from, or confirmation of them, from things that I'd written over the last 10 years, which I have in a number of places. And one of the points of American theocracy was that the United States, because the Republicans were based in the South, and because of the whole millennium overlap with the politics of the Middle East, were really sucked into this maw of a religious politics, which had domestic issues too, but it had foreign policy issues. and that the greatest support for all of this stuff was in the South, and it did not behoove the Republicans to become the Southern Party. For all that the liberals were enormously excited when I wrote The Emerging Republican Majority 40 years ago, the Republicans were in no way a Southern Party except in presidential voting. And slowly but surely they got it, and I would say since the George H.W. Bush administration, there's been enough flat-out pandering that it started to pose a problem. But it also did get them across the finish line in taking over Congress. And Bill Clinton was, of course, a gift to the Republicans in the South. The religious people below the Mason-Dixon line thought that he was the devil incarnate or the devil's fourth cousin or something, at least. And that was a major boost to George W., and so was 9/11. And it took the emptiness of George W. Bush in any cosmopolitan way to undo the incredible opportunity he had with the moral and religious constituencies in the United States, and enjoyed for about 2 years after 9/11.
Do you agree with Schaller that the Democrats could put together a winning coalition out of the coast and the upper Midwest?
Well, I told Schaller that if I were defining this, I would define it a little bit differently than he did. I would say that if you have a Democratic Party that is conspicuously in the Kerry Dukakis vein, let me put it that way, a northern party encumbered by the northern liberal elites as portrayed by the Republicans, which they will always trot out the portraiture, that's not good enough. You've got to be able to win rural central Pennsylvania, they call it the T. You've got to be able to win downstate Ohio, downstate Illinois, Missouri. There's a border state mentality that you can't ignore, even though you can ignore the core South, if you see what I mean. And you're not free to take an anti-Southern posture. You're just really free to assume that if the Republicans go overboard, they may keep the South, but they're at risk if you're playing your cards right and you're the other side. They're at risk in the Missouris and Ohios and rural Pennsylvanias and Arizonas. And in that sense, construed the way I said it, I don't have any problem with his thesis. I did see him at something a couple of days back, and I said, Obama, if he's the nominee, presents a new equation. There may be states in which he can get enough of the white vote to have a huge black turnout provide enough to elect him. Virginia's one possibility, I suppose, maybe Tennessee. But you have to go back. You have to go back to the political geographies. If it's Obama, there would be heavily white states in the South and border he might not have a chance in.
Will that the Republican use of the anti-liberal elite rhetoric, does that still have traction?
Oh, I think so. It's been trotted out in everything but its little elephant and eagle symbolism by Hillary. I mean, Hillary is, in essence, the pre-Republican in the election. She's trotting out all this stuff, which really is a weakness on Obama's part because he hasn't handled some of it too well. But I thought that it was very much overstated what he said about the bitterness, because I think I know what he was driving at. I don't have any sympathy with Reverend Wright. Everybody has a Reverend Wright, and everybody should know that. You want to keep him out of sight pretty early. So, yeah, I think he's going to have some real problems with that, because if he was white and he'd been the president of the Harvard Law Review, guess what you could call him? An elitist. And you'd probably be right.
I'm speaking with Kevin Phillips, author most recently of Bad Money. It looks like whoever takes office in January 2009 is really going to have a plateful. What do you see? We're not really having a very serious conversation about this stuff in this election campaign. So what do you see as the likely set of problems facing the new administration? Is it going to hit them like a ton of bricks right away?
Well, I think it will hit like a ton of bricks, but it doesn't have to. The problem is that if you want to play it safe in the election and not open up Pandora's box, you don't start talking about all this. And you don't talk about all of it until you're probably 6 to 9 months further into the evolutionary pattern of what's coming here. We have seen, I think, the first two, maybe three innings of a nine-inning game in terms of the economic disarray of the United States. And I understand why the politicians don't want to wrap that around themselves at the present time, because it's basically March or April before they're going to have serious legislation coming out of Congress, March or April 2009. And why lock up all your conceptual commitments at this point?
What do you see as a likely political fallout of the housing bust and the credit crunch? And it's almost certain that a recession is underway. We don't know how severe it's going to be, but it looks like it could be a bad one. What do you see as the political fallout?
Well, the position I take in the book is that one thing that seems pretty clear, we're headed for the biggest decline in home prices since the 1930s. And it's also pretty clear that the concentration of these problems is greatest in California, Arizona, Nevada, Florida, the Sun Belt. It should be a major threat to the Republicans. They should find it almost impossible to carry these states and throw in Ohio and Michigan, too, because of the old Rust Belt housing problems. Now, do they have a chance to carry these states this time? Yes, because of this unique fratricidal I love you not game put together by the Democratic contenders. And I've lost any Republicanism, but I can't develop a sense that the Democratic Party has as much to offer the public as it thinks it has, because I just see these things year after year. I see a Bush opposed by Michael Dukakis in 1988. I see the John Kerry farce running against George W., and I voted for Kerry, but I had to think about George W. every moment I was in the voting booth. And how the Democrats do this, I can't understand. There's such an ineffective opposition that I think if the Democrats lose the presidency to John McCain and they add, as I'm pretty sure they will, 15 House seats and 3 or 4 Senate seats, you're going to have a Democratic Party in there that figured if they had the average American with no record as their nominee, he would have been elected president in a no vote. But because they had these two talented people killing each other, they got a Republican president. I think that's a blueprint for another round of fratricide of a different kind. I don't think it can be a very constructive match to have a strengthened Democratic Congress with McCain. But I don't really see any terribly effective presidency coming out of this contest.
Is this kind of incoherence and chaos what you would expect in a nation in decline?
Yes, unfortunately. And see, that's the conclusion I hate to leap to. So I wait for somebody to ask the question as perfectly as you did. If you go back and you look at the patterns in Spain, in Holland, and in Britain, what you see is that as it becomes late enough that all these things should be an issue, and as people can start to see what's unfolding, you tend to have either a creaky party system or the interest groups are so entrenched there's no way to deal with them. Reformers find it hard to have a very effective voice. In the case of the British, between the two world wars, the party system was coming unglued. And you wound up with such a fragmented election, for example, in 1924, that Winston Churchill didn't run as a conservative, a liberal, or labor. He ran as a constitutionalist on an independent ballot. But the British party system was coming so unglued during this period, there was no way they could have blueprinted the sort of crisis approach that would have given Britain a shot at exiting from its problem. And I'm afraid we face something, the same thing here.
Is it possible that we could somehow mitigate the consequences of this decline, or is it just too baked in?
Well, the consequences of the decline, and this is something that after the book back in 2000 where I had to discuss this, I figured I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at the patterns in the previous countries pretty carefully. And generally what seems to happen is that as you peak and you get into all this hubris, and whether it's maritime imperialism, military, biblical, all the different flavors it comes in, you overdo it, you fight wars you can't afford, you get a whole lot of debt, finance takes over, and you can't run the country on finance when you're so much in debt. And basically you go through a 25, 40, 50-year decline pattern in which you lose all the accoutrements of imperialism and global hegemony, the huge military, the global policeman role, the foreign aid or subsidy provider, the global COP, diplomacy central, missionary spirits in religion, all this sort of thing. British had all of them. And by, obviously, as things were going down the drain, they lost them all. And it took the British from 1914, I would say, until the late 1950s to go through the trauma of exiting the previous role into the new role. But as much as 5-6 years after World War II, they were in enough difficulty, they still had food rationing in the United Kingdom after they had won, and I use that in quotation marks, World War II.
And that was Kevin Phillips, author most recently of Bad Money, just out from Penguin. That's it for me, Doug Henwood.
KPFA listeners, I'll be back next week with Joel Covell to talk about capitalism and the destruction of nature. WBAI listeners, I'll see you during the fundraiser. Let's go out with this from Killing Jokes, Another Bloody Election. Bye.